From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. This is our special Halloween episode. I am joined by, returning this week, Mr. Stuart Bulk. Say hello, Stuart.
Well, hello!
And also joining me is Mr. John Grace in his haunted castle in Colorado. Say hello, John.
Hello. Friend. Hunter's my friend. Stuart's my friend.
Smoke. Good. Drink. Good. Trump. Good. Hillary. Bad.
Yes. We are doing, don't be mistaken, fam, because we're not doing Bride of Frankenstein. That movie's been talked about to death by everybody. Instead, we're doing one of the less appreciated sequel, Son of Frankenstein, which I think people sort of unfairly dismiss. You know, Ian McKellen in Gods and Monsters goes, oh, those sequels were directed by Hacks. So people go, oh, well, those are bad. I'm not going to watch them.
Yeah.
But in fact, I think Son of Frankenstein is even crazier with the German expressionist visuals and references and – you know, it's a very, very entertaining sequel in its own right. In fact, the angry video game nerd himself, James Rolfe, ranked it above Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein in his Universal Monster Movie Rundown.
Yeah, he would.
Yeah.
I think he's wrong. Yeah. But
I'm not saying he's right, but I think it shows that it's kind of getting a little bit of a reappraisal.
It's getting a reappraisal because those sequels have all been so dismissed. Because they weren't directed by...
Well, because nobody...
Just, like, summed up, so...
Yeah, because they're getting dismissed, yeah. And,
But guys like him always say, oh, well, you know, Jaws 3, it's, if you look at it closely, it's just as good as Jaws. It's like, you know, they just do that to be subversive and...
Well, I don't think James is being subversive because I think he's on the spectrum autistic-wise. I mean, like, look at the way he's handled the... controversy with Ghostbusters, where he said he wouldn't review the all-female Ghostbusters. He didn't even respond to it because I think he lives in a bubble that where politics and signaling doesn't exist.
Well, at least he doesn't live in a rape bubble like Devin Faraci.
Exactly. No, I'm a big fan of James Rolfe. I think he's one of the few voices out there that.
Hold on, Hunter. Hunter, you're saying a guy who makes YouTube videos where he rants for like 10 minutes is on the spectrum? Are you kidding me?
Well, it's funny, like, that character he plays is like a joke, but when you see him in, like, as himself, it's like, oh, this is that guy who was really quiet and weird in high school. And,
I think that's everybody. I think eventually we're going to have to disregard a lot of these labels because it's getting where anybody smart is being labeled on the spectrum. It's really weird.
By the way, John, what's it like having autism?
You know, because I don't see the world that way. I see it in a slightly different color.
Stuart, do you have any of Vivaldi we can play? Sorry.
In 2 days of edit time? No, I don't think so. I've got some list that help.
Yeah, that helps. That helps.
Well, I think one thing people forget, and it's mostly people who review movies today who have no knowledge of how studios were run back then, there's a consistency with Universal product. Like, that was the studio that basically made slick movies for children, which was Abbott and Costello and their monster movies. They were not really famous for much else. Like, they were kept afloat by Abbott and Costello and monsters until, I mean, their biggest hit in 1961 or 62 or whatever, Save the Studio, was King Kong versus Godzilla.
Oh, they had the Marx Brothers stuff as well.
Yeah. I mean, they had that stuff they've now lost.
I think, did they have the Marx Brothers or somebody else?
They had the Marx Brothers.
Okay. I think that was Paramount. Am I wrong?
Or no, it might have... Wait, so let's.
I was going to remember Universal bought a bunch of the Paramount library in the 1950s.
Oh, like
Paramount was like, no one's going to watch these. No one wants to watch these old movies.
Okay. So. No, it was Paramount, and then that was, and after that they moved to MGM, and that's when they started making kind of.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah. I was thinking the early Marx Brothers stuff was might have been Universal, but it wasn't.
No, yeah, it's Paramount.
Right.
Universal was always famous for like the. You know, the genre stuff that was, you know,
Cape Fear,
it was essentially for kids.
Cape Fear isn't, but for the most part, their stuff was for children. It's these monster movies were all for kids.
Cape Fear remake's horrible as well. I do not like
it. Oh, it's awful.
The original was way better.
Right. Well, you know, I saw the original in a theater recently, so with Elroy hosting. So,
Robert De Niro is, you know, he's fucking terrible when he's great when he plays like Al Capone villain, but he's terrible when he has to play a movie monster like Max Cady or Frankenstein's Monster.
I have my revenge. Frankenstein with De Niro face.
My favorite De Niro acting moment is the one that kind of sums up his entire skill is the scene in The Untouchables where Al Capone's at the opera and he gets whispered into his ear by Nitty or whatever that they just killed the Sean Connery character, and he's crying from the opera, and then he starts laughing, and that's really all the De Niro you really have to see.
Yeah,
that's it right there.
I've absolutely lost any sort of interest in De Niro.
Yeah, well, I watched Mean Streets recently, and I hadn't seen it in years, and I realized that I always, you know, no offense to our East Coast listeners, but I always sum up East Coast people as like, hey, I'm over here, hey, my dick, you know, and I watched Mean Streets, and that's how everybody talks in that movie. I said, maybe this is where I got the joke. Hey! Every scene of dialogue, hey! Hey! I'm right here!
I still enjoy Mean Streets, though.
That's a good film, but that's where a lot of the stereotypes. It's basically Yiddish theater version of Italians.
Oh, yeah.
As Danny Aiello had described it. He said they're not acting like real Italians. He says they're acting like Yiddish theater versions of Italians. And he's right. He's never worked for Scorsese, I guess, because he called him a fucking midget or something. he was apparently at an Oscar. He described this in an interview with Gilbert Gottfried. He says that he was at a party and Scorsese was at a dinner table nearby, and he went, "That fucking midget's never hired me." And
so then, I won't work for that midget, but I'll work for the other midget, Spike Lee. Right? Okay.
Right.
the more hateful midget.
Well, I guess Spike is really respectful to guys like Danny Aiello, so I don't know.
Yeah, because I want to play him as a token Italian pizza owner, like, you know?
I need to be respectful because I really need to denigrate his people in Jungle Fever.
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of conservative actors do seem to work with Spike Lee. Like James Woods had him direct the pilot of his TV show, Shark or whatever, and Woods is pretty conservative. So,
oh yeah, very much.
Maybe he's extremely respectful to work with. You know, he does the whole amped up racial crap for the PR, but you know, apparently
he's slowed it down over the last few years, you know.
Well, it hasn't gotten him anywhere. I mean, he was trying to crowdfund his last movie.
Good.
Yeah, I mean,
what's the BLM movement there? Come on.
Let's not take a moment to remember he did block me on Twitter.
Okay. Oh, he did.
That's why he has to crowdfund these days because people like him.
Did you call him an ebony midget or something on Twitter?
No, I said he was sharing. He was having a Twitter meltdown over something he shared from MSNBC, and I said, dude, like this is total. This that's not even what happened. It was something that like was easily, you know, refuted. And I was like, dude, you know that's horseshit, right? I mean, it's MSNBC. Like, come on. And he goes, what? Am I supposed to watch Fox News every day?
I do.
Wake up. And he goes, wake up. And then he blocked me.
Jesus. I remember the best way to describe Spike Lee was when he had made an appearance on Arsenio Hall and he was ripping on Eddie Murphy for not getting more blacks hired at Paramount Pictures. So Eddie goes on the next week and he goes, man, I see Spike out here and all these girls are hooting and hollering for him. And Spike's sitting there like, man, I'm fine. And Spike looks like a cricket.
That may be the funniest thing Eddie Murphy said in like 30 years, I think.
It was back in like 1991 or whatever. And,
right.
Oh, yeah. And Eddie really ripped into him and they had a feud, you know. Murphy didn't really get along with that later generation of those artists and stuff. He just, you know, he seems to be doing his own thing. I noticed he never promoted hip hop or anything in his movies.
Nope.
You know, I don't think he cared. I think he's like a Stevie Wonder, you know, Sly Stone type of guy.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Rick James, that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's funny with Spike used to say a lot of things about the Jewish filmmakers and stuff.
Oh yeah.
Cuz I think Norman Jewison was supposed to direct Malcolm X. And Spike made a big public stink about it. So that should be directed by a black director.
Ridiculous. Yeah. I'm glad Living Color made fun of Spike as many times as they did.
Oh yeah, and they I know that Ernest Dickerson, I'm friends with Ernest's cousin, and he was the cinematographer who basically gave Spike the look of his films. And
yeah, I mean, like, said, like Spike's movies became visually uninteresting the moment he stopped working with Ernest Dickerson.
Yeah, and Ernest told his cousin, he goes, "They captured Spike. That's exactly the way he is. That is like a perfect impression. That is exactly the way he acts. Like, that's him." You know, it's like he nailed it.
What was that film Spike did about where he had that big montage at the end of just, you know, all the early racist shit in Hollywood, like that.
Oh, Bamboozled.
Bamboozled. Thank you.
Oh yeah. Mantan. It's just Damon Wayans completely overacting for like night.
Hey, don't tell me that I can't use the N word. I have a black girlfriend and two biracial children.
Oh, is that De Blasio?
Michael, like, that was Michael Rappaport.
Oh, I thought it was Bill de Blasio.
Same thing.
Yeah, yeah, really.
They're the same person.
Yes.
Anyway, so, but back to Frankenstein. So,
who was a good Jewish monster, by the way? Frank N. Stein.
Well, he's a golem, you know.
Der Golem. Oh, he's like Gene Simmons. Yeah.
He's der Golem. Anyway, but, you know, one thing that kind of struck me watching this movie is that in the Frankenstein mythos, we have this, like the pop culture mythos, I should say, not the official, you know, Mary Shelley mythos, because he didn't even have an assistant in the book like that. But you have that image of Frankenstein and his hunchback assistant, Igor. And I was kind of wondering where that comes from, since this is the first movie where we see that. Does it come from this movie? Was this movie more influential in the pop culture than we realized? I was kind of thinking about that while I was watching it.
Well, it was influential on a particular guitarist on the Misfits. Well, Wolfgang von Frankenstein. That was never mentioned before in the other Frankenstein films.
Right, so, right.
Taken from this. The one thing I noticed about this film, which I had never picked up on before, if you watch Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein, the one they were released in order, the way they were released in order, I should say, sorry, this basically eliminates Bride of Frankenstein altogether.
Yeah.
It reverts back Frankenstein to non-speech, just, you know, grunting and growling.
Yeah.
He had the power of speech in that. And no mention of the bride at all. So, therefore, not able to talk to Frankenstein or the son of Frankenstein. And no mention of where's my bride. Nothing like that. Like, just completely wipes out Bride of Frankenstein, which is probably, I consider now, the best of the Frankenstein films. I always thought it was the first one for many, many years, but upon rewatching Bride of Frankenstein, probably about 2 or 3 weeks back, on a heat of the moment sort of thing, I was like, I want to watch Bride of Frankenstein, and I thought it was fantastic. I absolutely loved it, and
it's hilarious too.
It is. It really is. It is truly a masterpiece of a film.
Like, it's very friggin' funny. Very funny.
One of my favorite bits is when Dr. Pretorius, he shows his little King Henry VIII, and he's like lusting after these princesses in other glasses. It's hilarious.
It basically eliminates it. I'm like,
well, and I don't think they were as concerned with continuity between films back then.
That didn't matter back then.
I've been watching the Peter Cushing Hammer Frankenstein movies, and all of those, like, they follow, like, the first few follow some sort of a thread, but they greatly, like, overlook big elements of the plot from the previous movie.
I could understand what you were saying if they had Lon Chaney as Frankenstein like they did in other films, or Glenn Strange. Sure. But this is Boris Karloff. You would have thought, I had lines back in the other one. Where are all the lines now? Or maybe he was just like, I don't give a shit. I just want this over with. This is the last time I ever played Frankenstein in a film, I believe. So maybe he was like, oh, give me the money. I'll do it. Just let's just get this over with. Probably.
Well, I don't think. I don't know. I just don't think they were as concerned with that stuff. I don't know. Like
they weren't consistent. Because okay, you got to remember that people only saw these movies. This is before television, and people only saw these movies on revivals, like double feature bills, and Universal would make each one, assuming you hadn't seen the others, and so.
Well, the whole reason this movie was made was because Frankenstein was making money hand over fist at a revival screening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's why this movie was made.
You mean they didn't have Netflix back in the 30s?
No.
Man, they're so old.
They didn't have the Pirate Bay either.
No.
No. Didn't have torrents. Didn't have anything. Yeah. It's like, you know, they just got away with repeating some stuff and creating some new things. Yeah. I think it works remarkably well for something that they're basically just kind of trying to make its own standalone and a sequel of sorts, because back then they didn't think sequels. There's no direct sequels to a lot of movies back then. It's interesting how that worked.
It had to work as its own independent thing. I mean, like, even Bride of Frankenstein feels more like a sequel than most movies from back then. You know?
Yeah, it's and I think it's just because it's the same director and a lot of the same talent behind the camera and everything. And another aspect is, like, what I really laughed about, and it shows how popular Frankenstein was with the pop culture back then. There's a line that Basil Rathbone, playing Frankenstein's son, saying, why most people think that, call that creature my father's name, or he has a line like that. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, people were doing it, you know?
I know, and, like, you watch a recent piece of garbage like Victor Frankenstein, and it makes those little jokes, and it sort of thinks it's being clever. But yeah. This monster will usurp your name, you know. It's just ridiculous. Like, this movie, Son of Frankenstein, was doing that well before it. And even, like, I also thought the plot was remarkably similar to – even the look of it was Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, that was a huge –
a lot of long shots. Yeah, a lot of long shots.
Like, yeah, it has the sort of distorted, out-of-proportion sets and shadows. But also you have the – Bela Lugosi character Igor is using the monster as a somnambulist killer. Like, he hypnotizes him and has him sleepwalk to go kill people, just like in Caligari. And Hammer used the same plot in Evil of Frankenstein, where there's that carnival showman who is able to hypnotize the monster to go kill for him and steal for him and stuff.
I will say, in my opinion, this is by far Bela Lugosi's best performance.
It is. It's great.
It is fantastic.
It is such a repulsive performance. I'll say, like, when he points out his broken neck and knocks on it, I was fucking crawling it. I was like, oh, God, that's fucking gross. Like, you know.
And this is what's funny is I was reading up on it. He was wrangled into the film at the last minute by the director as a favor because the director liked him. Universal executives didn't care for Lugosi. But I think they lowballed him an offer, and he was only supposed to be on the film for like 2 weeks, and the director had the screenwriter add the Igor, add more Igor scenes, so basically Lugosi could work for like 8 or 9 weeks on the film, and he ended up making a lot of money off of it.
Support his heroin.
Yeah, his terrible habits and everything.
Yeah, I think we see Bela Lugosi as he would be if he was a homeless Hungarian junkie, like he very well could have been.
I tell you what, every time I watch this film, it reminds me so much of my mate Rob's dad, Joe. He just sounds exactly like Igor. Hey, Stewie, come here, have a drink. It's like, okay, Rob, you know your dad sounds like Lugosi in Son of Frankenstein. You're like, what are you going to do? He's a wog. European immigrant.
Yeah. But it is arguably Lugosi's best performance. It's better.
I would say inarguably, for sure. I think it's better than Dracula. For those of you who've seen Dracula, which is probably about everybody on the planet, it's a boring ass film, really.
No, it doesn't work. It's a film stage play.
The Spanish the Spanish one's far more atmospheric
because it's made like a movie.
Yeah,
I will say I really like Dracula with the Philip Glass score. Even though it never shuts up, I watched the movie. And maybe it's just seeing it new for the first time, because I'll agree with you. Like, when I saw Dracula, I was like, okay, it has great moments, but it's pretty boring. I mean, it's kind of slow. But I thought when I saw it with the Philip Glass score, and I know that's not how it was originally made. This is retrofitting a score. But I thought it added so much creepiness and atmosphere to it, and it made some scenes really pop for me, and I really enjoyed watching it with that. But
as
you know,
as you said, it never shuts up. That's the whole problem.
That's the only.
Quiet moments in there.
That's the only complaint I had about the Philip Glass score was that it goes throughout. It doesn't ever sort of, you know, take a breather.
And but, Philip Glass he's a gifted composer. So
oh,
you'd think it's okay, here, let's just bring it down a little, quiet. No, there's none of that.
But I will say, I think the original Dracula score is way too fucking quiet.
Like, it is. So there's no balance there. It's like one, you know, pounds you in the face repeatedly, and then one's like too quiet. It's just basically Swan Lake, and that's it. I think that's all you get.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, but I do really like Lugosi as Dracula. I think he's fantastic.
Oh, he is. Yeah, but just myself personally, I find his Igor performance in Son of Frankenstein just...
But,
excellent.
But any day of the week, though, I'd rather watch Frankenstein. I'd rather watch The Wolfman. I'd rather watch The Mummy. You know, like, I think all of those are better movies than Dracula. And plus, like, Todd Browning, by all accounts, was kind of checked out when he directed the film. He was sort of not in a great place because of Lon Chaney's death, from what I've understood.
Yeah.
I'd rather watch Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein than watch Dracula.
Right.
I'd actually rather watch that than, like, 90% of the Universal Monster movies.
But like, I do love the Dwight Fry performance. It's really fucking unhinged and good in that movie. He's good at that kind of.
And it inspired a great Alice Cooper song. So
yes, yeah, it did.
Yeah. Probably one of the best.
But you said you prefer it to most the Universal Monsters movies. Do you mean most of the sequels, or are there some of the other originals so far?
Most of the sequels. Like when I went back and watched a lot of the Mummy movies, I didn't realize like the last few were made as comedies.
Yeah, with Vincent Price, wasn't it?
No, that might have been the Invisible. I didn't get the Invisible Man set.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, wrong set. Invisible Man.
Yeah, that might be what you're thinking of. The last Mummy movie had like a now obscure comedian in it and stuff, and was mostly played for laughs and used stock footage from the Karloff original, which I do like a lot. There's one of them that actually has a downer ending where the mummy takes the girl in the swamp and they drown in the swamp. Like, the girl does not live. It's kind of stunning.
That's okay, because, I mean, once Mr. Trump gets in, he's going to drain the swamp.
He is going to drain the swamp, yeah. And he'll be able to pull her out.
Yeah, but then the funny thing about that mummy film is after that ending, the next film started with them digging the mummy up from a drained swamp of, like, mud or whatever. They were bulldozing and found the mummy. So they actually had direct continuity with that one. But, I mean, I do enjoy them, but I think Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is one of the only horror comedies that works. Because I think, for the most part, those hardly ever work.
I will say my favorite of all is The Invisible Man still. It always will be.
Man's amazing.
It's a masterpiece.
It is so timeless. A few years ago, I was babysitting my friend's kids. He and his wife were going out for Halloween. I wasn't doing anything. And they were like, hey, can you stay with our kids? And I went, sure. And I brought over The Invisible Man, and I watched The Invisible Man with his kids, and they loved it. And I said, do you want to see more movies like this? And they were like, yeah. And so my friend was I was talking to him the other day, and he was like, oh, you know, looking for something to watch with the kids for Halloween. I said, show them some Universal Monster movies, dude. Like, they'll eat that shit up. And he was like, oh, you're right.
You fools.
Fools, kids still love them. They still love that stuff.
It is a great performance. But I like the Creature from the Black Lagoon movies from the 50s. I think those are
Oh, my goodness.
Best.
That in 3D is unbelievable.
Those movies gave us the greatest male of our time, Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The second one did. That's right.
Revenge of the Creature.
He's got the mouse in his pocket. You know, doing his routine even then.
What was a Democrat doing in my pocket? Get out of here, man. Justice warrior doing in here? Get out of here.
I've noticed, but stuff like the House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, I was surprised how juvenile they were when I watched them.
They're not good. I watched Ghost of Frankenstein the other day as well, and I quite enjoyed that.
That's
a really trim 65 minutes, like in and out. Really
well, that's
quick.
Also an extremely funny Lugosi performance.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, Son of Frankenstein's unusually long. It's almost 100 minutes.
It really
is. The other Frankenstein movies are like 70 minutes, like 65 minutes, you know.
Yeah. It did feel it at times as well. It felt just slightly padded out.
Yeah.
You know,
They had a lot of top names in it, like Rathbone. Was a big deal.
Lionel Atwill, yeah.
It had the Orgy Master General, Lionel Atwill. Lionel Atwill, who was an avid host of orgies at his Hollywood home.
I also think that's why Mel Brooks chose this one to basically spoof with Young Frankenstein, because he's basically directly spoofing the script of this.
Yeah,
and
pretty much.
I was surprised because I saw Young Frankenstein first when I was a kid, and I was surprised to see that the policeman with the wooden arm was actually in Son of Frankenstein. I was like, wow.
Oh, really?
He really? Yeah.
Okay. I love Lionel Atwill's wooden arm in this movie. It's so much fun.
Because it's Kenneth Mars in the Young Frankenstein, and it's one of the better jokes in that. He puts the darts in his arm. It's like, I haven't seen it in years, and my wife even said, if you order that, you know, let's watch that together, because I haven't seen it.
It is still good. It still holds up very well.
I have to get it. So although I caught the walk this way joke in an earlier comedy, like I think in the like a Daffy Duck cartoon, like in the 1950s. So they've been doing that joke forever. But yeah, I think that's why the long plot, that's why Mel Brooks kind of zeroed in on this one. But Rathbone, I had read some details on it on IMDb and Wikipedia, and they said he didn't like horror films. And so he totally camped it up in some scenes, and he's completely overdoing it. I guess to discourage executives from hiring him for these horror films, but then that they ended up loving that about him.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, he's very entertaining in this movie.
Yeah, he just completely overdoes it. And I love his stuntman that like kicks the monster into the lava at the end of the fire.
I prefer him as Sherlock Holmes. His Sherlock Holmes films are fantastic.
Yeah, he's a terrific Sherlock Holmes. Still, I think, the best theatrical Sherlock Holmes of all time.
Yep.
Wasn't he in Adventures of Zorro?
He was the villain in Adventures of Zorro.
Yeah,
and was actually a highly skilled... he's a highly skilled swordsman. Like, he was very good at fencing. And
it would be good to see him have a duel with Bruce Dickinson.
Or the Mark of Zorro. I'm sorry, Mark of Zorro.
Oh, okay.
Mark of Zorro. That's it. With the one with Tyrone Power. And then he's also the villain in Robin Hood, with the Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn. And everybody thinks he's a sheriff of Nottingham. He's actually his villain is actually the Sir Guy of Gisborne. So the Sheriff of Nottingham is not the main villain in that classic Errol Flynn Robin Hood film, which I still think is the best Robin Hood movie.
I will say HD DVD still.
Oh, God.
Still got quite a few of those.
Yeah, and I actually watched that a couple of weeks ago and thought it was terrific. Like, I hadn't watched it in years. Another Michael Curtiz masterpiece.
Yes.
And it's like completely not filmed in England, yet feels like the most authentic Robin Hood film still. Doesn't even have English accents, you know, that everybody was speaking that transatlantic, you know, mid-Atlantic accent or whatever you want to call it. And it works. It still works better than the ones that were made in England by Hammer. You know,
they should have had an accent that drops in and out like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Don't even stop me on that.
That thing's so unwatchable.
the only person that I really liked was Alan Rickman. That was it. All the rest was just like, eh.
But do any of you guys know much about the director of this movie, Rowland V. Lee?
No, I was looking at his filmography. It's pretty
impressive.
Wasn't
that the guy who killed the Yankees in the South?
No, that's Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee.
Oh, sorry, one person.
That everybody in the South claims they're related to.
Yes. Do they? Oh, my God. Yeah. It's Robert E. Lee, and it's also like Founding Fathers. Oh, I'm related to Thomas Jefferson. Oh,
yeah.
I'm related. No, you're fucking not. You're just not.
It's as bad as people who believe in reincarnation who always claim they were Cleopatra.
Oh, I know. Yeah, people who believe in reincarnation were never a peasant that fucking died of.
Nah, life. Just not some British
Middle Ages.
Yeah, it was some.
You were never some Saracen who got beheaded by a crusader. You're just. You're always fucking, you know, Ramses.
I noticed that the director, Roland Lee, directed Tower of London with Rathbone and Karloff, and also Vincent Price is in that one. And he also directed Captain Kidd, which was his last film, and that was with Charles Laughton and Randolph Scott.
Yeah, it looks like there's a lot of like genre stuff, like some Fu Manchu.
Yeah, I think he was sort of a second level, like a craftsman that you assigned to sequels that you wanted him to look good.
A journeyman.
Yeah, journeyman director. He wasn't like the A-list, but he was definitely a respected journeyman.
People went, that guy, he's good people.
Yeah, he'll get it done. It's like, but it's funny that he did something as subversive as basically roping Lugosi into being on the film a lot longer than he was supposed to be. It sounds like Joe Spinell's deal with Coppola on The Godfather.
Just hang around and get paid.
He got paid and he ended up making more money than DeNiro.
Second highest paid actor on the whole Godfather saga, yeah.
Well, and, you know, this movie has stunning black and white photography. I mean, it looks fantastic. I mean, I was watching it on Blu-ray and it just is amazing.
Oh, you picked up that set? Okay.
Yeah, I did.
I need to get the Blu-ray because my old 2003 Universal box set just has like a Macrovision flicker on these films.
Does yours, does yours have a horrible like purple or greenish stripe down the side?
No, I did not notice that.
Okay, so I've got the Australian release of this, the Frankenstein Legacy Collection, and for this film only, it's got this horrible greenish purplish. You know how it's a 4x3, so it's got the sides blocked off down the left side, so you're looking out of your left eye, it's got this color, it's all the way through. I'm thinking, what the hell is this? This is bloody horrible.
At first I noticed my TV. No such issue.
Okay, yeah, I noticed. So it must be a strain print then. All right.
Yeah, I noticed no such issue, but it's also not like the disc has skipping problems. It's a totally smooth, you know, scratch free disc. And it gets stalled in certain scenes. And it's like, this is the early days, I think, of layered DVDs. And they didn't really pull out all the stops with this. And it looks like a VHS master or the Laserdisc master.
It doesn't look good on DVD.
Do you have the Legacy Collection, John?
Yeah, it came in the green packaging.
Yeah, I had that, and I traded it in and got the Blu-ray set.
So how does the Blu-ray
work? I'm going to do that because this is unacceptable quality.
It's worth it, and it has more movies than the other one. It comes with Abbott Costello.
Yeah, it does.
It comes with House of Frankenstein, Dracula, Frankenstein Meets the Wolf. It has, like, everything.
Okay.
If you look at this,
I think, a bunch of those, but it doesn't have Abbott Costello.
But if you look at the Wolfman box set, it has, like, all the same fucking
movies. Yeah, I know. It's doubled up a lot. Yeah, yeah. I don't know what they were thinking over there when they did that.
I know. It's ridiculous.
And but, by the Dracula Wolfman separately.
It's one of those things you just buy it to get the Wolfman. But this movie, it has great black and white photography. Like, the Blu-ray looks amazing, but this actually was originally, if I'm not mistaken, was planned to be shot in Technicolor.
Yes.
And they decided not to do it, but you can find stills of Karloff in the monster makeup for this movie that are in color, where you can see him in his monster regalia in full color. But I think this movie would have been much worse in color. I'm glad they shot it in black and white.
Well, they found a real shot in Technicolor, and apparently either been stolen or it's in a New Jersey warehouse, depending on what story you want to believe. It was stolen or was shipped in 1988 by quote unquote heartless bureaucrats at Universal, which isn't hard to believe being Universal.
Another thing you can see as well is a recently unearthed lost trailer for this film.
Oh, yes. We posted it on the Facebook page. So go join our Facebook page and stroke our asses and then go look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
We're getting a lot of love over there, which we are very
appreciative. We're getting a lot of love lately. It's really cool.
Yeah, we're getting new fans. Well, we're basically – apparently a lot of people are fed up with the some attitude with some other shows.
Yeah.
And I named them, but
I don't listen to most other movie podcasts because it's just they're
too safe.
You know. They're too safe, or they just are media podcasts masked with, but that have other agendas. They just want to dildo the fuck out of movies, you know.
Right.
Which is not us, thankfully.
Yeah. I don't know.
I couldn't do it. But recently unearthed trailer, and I think it's actually a far superior trailer to the one we've seen over the last 60, 70 years, whatever it is, of this film. I prefer it much more.
I mean, in truth, I can watch any of these Universal monster movies anytime.
Yeah, they're like candy. They're like Halloween candy.
Even the ones I only think are like 2-3-star movies, I could still watch them.
Well, I can watch Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman all the time. I mean, that's
considered one of the weakest ones, and I can
still love it. I fucking love it. It's also, you got Lon Chaney as the monster, and you got alcoholic Lon Chaney going, oh, I'm the Wolfman. Oh, I get drunk and I turn into a wolf. One thing, speaking of James Rolfe again, he was saying that there was a book published that was like a script, an unused script for Dracula versus the Wolfman. And it was one of these, it was never made, obviously. And he was saying some people think it's fake, but, you know, you see elements of the plot that are used later. And also the script, Dracula and the Wolfman never actually fight. But I was wondering if any of you guys had ever heard of that.
No, I haven't. This is the first I've heard of it. And there is a lot of, like, legends and innuendos about the Universal movies. Because you got to remember, for the famous Monster Kids in the 1960s and I guess up to the mid-70s before Star Wars and the end of cinema, Universal monster movies were probably the most overanalyzed and discussed among fandom. So there's
Famous Monsters magazine. Like, you had all those fanzines that were just all about this stuff. You know,
basically, Jack Pierce makeup sold that magazine, and I think that was Forry Ackerman's wheelhouse. It was basically those movies, and even though they had coverage of the Hammer films, which were really popular at the time among the monster kids, but the Universal stuff was the most. That was the Star Wars of that fandom.
Yeah. No, it really was. I mean, like Forry Ackerman and all those guys, you know, they sort of that was the fan culture before Star Wars came and, you know, annihilated it.
Yeah. I mean, stuff like the Munsters was in even the Addams Family. It was kind of like a cash in on the monster kid boom of the 60s. Big Daddy Roth, you know, cars and all that wonderful stuff and Harryhausen films. I mean, people don't realize that's what kids were into. These were all made for children back then.
I want to ask you guys, now that we've just John's just mentioned that, what are you more, Munsters or Addams Family person?
Addams Family, because Morticia and Gomez were probably the only married couple on 60s television that were incredibly sexualized. Oh, I mean, they flirt and he's kissing her arm constantly and stuff. You don't see that anywhere else in 60s TV. You never see any of the parents, like, affectionate. So it's very unique. A lot of the dark humor. Now, I like stuff about the Munsters, but I have a hard time sitting through both shows because the laugh track is so excessive. I wish they would.
Laugh tracks are like fucking kiss of death to me.
Oh, they're horrible. It makes them, like, I love Get Smart when I was a kid, and I bought all the sets on DVD without looking at them, and I tried to get through some episodes, and the laugh track is so annoying.
Like, when I go back and watch those shows like Get Smart, I loved as a kid, I can't get through them because the laugh track is so awful.
I like it. I like them.
Oh, I'm sure. No, the show, I'm not saying it's not great, but the laugh track just makes it hard for me to sit through. It's just.
Yeah, it is tough. And even my favorite, SCTV, although they seem to overdo the laugh track as if to make it part of the joke. But they can be tough sometimes. And especially like those 60s shows, the laugh track is really loud. You know, as if they wanted to.
Thank God we never got Batman with a laugh track.
I mean, I'm sure we were close to it.
Very close, yeah.
But to answer your question, Stu, I would probably say the Munsters because I watched that more when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Never really got into the Addams Family. I knew the Addams Family movies. That was about it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm more of a Munsters, but I must say I do like those Addams Family movies. They are good.
Yeah, Raul Julia is fantastic.
One. Oh, yeah. And
Angelica Houston looked like a big tranny as Morticia, and that was kind of...
Yeah.
Like, Morticia should be super fucking hot, because...
Well, like Carolyn Jones was, yeah.
Yeah, she was super hot as Morticia, and it's like, that inspired all this Elvira and more than Vampira did, you know.
You reckon?
Oh, yeah. Totally. People forget, because Angelica Houston was so portrayed Morticia as very unattractive and manly, and, you know, it's not the same thing. No, it's like Carolyn Jones is a total sex symbol on that show.
Yeah.
That's what inspired. Vampire wasn't seen very much outside of L.A.
Well, even the color is still very attractive.
You know, like outside of Lynn Danzig's friend's circle, Vampire.
Right. And that's because he watched Planet Nine from Outer Space.
Oh, yeah.
Over and over and over again.
And that's how we all saw her, because I never saw Vampire. I never even saw clips of Vampire anywhere, you know.
No, there are no clips remaining. I think they've all...
Yeah, I don't think any kinescopes exist or anything. I don't think...
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a documentary about Vampire out there called Vampire and Me. There may be some in that. I don't know.
I remember reading that there's no footage remaining, but...
Okay, well, that may be the case. I've not seen these documentaries.
I've never seen destroyed tapes.
I've seen plenty of Vampira documentary stuff. I've never seen a stitch of her show footage. The only thing I've seen are the recreations Tim Burton did in Ed Wood.
Yeah. Well, they would have had something to go by as a reference.
Right. And they may have had her.
They may have had her as a technical advisor, I guess, on that sort of stuff. Yeah. True.
Or they may have had old. They may have found old TV scripts when they were researching the screen.
Possibly, yeah, yeah.
And they had consultants. So, and it's possible people had audio recordings because back then you put a tape recorder up to the TV and tried to record movies and TV shows.
A bit like my friend back in high school when he he recorded the audio of what was it? Nightmare on Elm Street 4 in a theater. Then the next. Like, he would just go back to the drive-in screen, sync up the film on the drive-in screen from a distance back and listen to it on his tape recorder.
Weird.
Yeah.
That's something else. But, I mean, it's funny because I have a friend who taped, he still has his audio tapes of Hawaii Five-0 from the 70s. And he could tell you that footage is missing from the DVD versions because he's got the audio with the extra dialogue.
And people don't know this. They just think, oh, it must be the way it was when it aired. But a lot of shows out there that are on home video now have got, you know, maybe a minute missing here or a minute there. Thank God with that Batman set that I was talking about a number of episodes back. Somebody out there must have known Batman every episode back to front. And they said, hang on, when Footwolves first released that set, they're like, they're missing this and it's missing this. And thank God those people are out there because Warner would not have gone back and reinstated those missing bits. They would have said, oh, it's out there now. You wanted it all these years? Take it. We'll leave it. So thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's because apparently they didn't take care of the Hawaii Five-0 prints in their vault at Paramount. So that's why we still have that episode that only aired once where the girl hung herself at the beginning. And that one's been banned ever since because I guess there was a suicide or teen suicide that they thought was imitating that show. And
someone hung themselves. Must be because of this show.
And it's like, why not restore it for DVD? They didn't care. Paramount just slapped them on the DVD box sets and just like, no bonus stuff, nothing like that. Screw you. It's just like Route 66. Some of the episodes on DVD of the first season are wretched looking. It's like they couldn't find good prints, and I understand there's actually a dispute over who actually owns the show, if it's the producer or the studio.
I hate that shit when it's tied up in legal issues.
Exactly. It's like it's insane. You would have thought that would be figured out by now, but no, it isn't.
They just, all that sort of crap. So that's another episode for another time, that discussion. That's sure.
Yeah, definitely. But luckily, Universal really did preserve their old prints, and so we get very consistent home video releases of this stuff. And I find they hold up better than, a horror film from 20 years ago. So it's like not...
or a horror film from last year.
From yesterday. Yeah, it's like there's not much out there that I care about.
I don't want to hear about found footage films anymore. People like them. I totally get it. And good luck to you, but I don't care.
I don't care about a Babadook. I don't care about
it. I don't care. I don't care if your movie's directed by a woman. I don't care.
No.
I don't care if it's a bunch of Sunday school atheist preaching. I can't stand that stuff. I get tired of it. Like that one with the Black Philip goat that like kills the whole thing.
The witch was fucking terrible.
That retarded shit.
And Bret Easton Ellis delivered a great takedown of the Babadook. I hate that word takedown. He delivered a great critical piece on the Babadook and the witch especially. Like he really nailed a lot of what was wrong with it.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and another thing is that I noticed that these old Universal films, even if they're kind of hacky, like Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, their acting is so much better than the acting that they get away with in horror films these days.
Oh, totally. Like, I mean, dude, it's one of those things where I was thinking about that, how you just can't recreate anything like that today. The sensibilities just aren't the same. You can't go out and say, you know what, I'm going to make a movie that's true to the sensibility. You're going to fuck it up. You just can't do it. It's impossible. It's been so long since I've seen like a horror movie that really gets to me. And you know, this, I don't think this movie's that scary. It has moments that fucking roil me, but you know,
some nice pieces of suspense, but it's designed to be scary to kids.
it's not, you know, like, I mean, people like to go like, oh, you know, those movies are terrible. It's really the Val Lewton ones, if you want, you know. And Val Lewton,
you never see the terror.
You never see the terror.
And suspense.
I don't want to signal hard against Val Lewton. I like some of those movies. Body Snatcher is a masterpiece, but
The Leopard Man's really good.
And Leopard Man. I like Bedlam's my favorite. That film freaked me the hell out when I saw that.
Bedlam's great. You know, it made some great movies, but I love a good monster. And, you know, I think Karloff's monster, that look is just – you just can't beat it, man. That sleepy eye.
It's so iconic. Universal copyrighted it, and no one can have their monster look like that.
Nope. Yep. They Evil of Frankenstein got to do it because it was distributed by Universal.
Yeah,
so they
made a deal. Well, they also did that design in the Hammer TV pilot made in cooperation with Universal in the 1950s. It's pretty
cool.
Did they have a Frankenstein in Van Helsing?
Yes.
Yeah, I think
okay.
they did, and he's the philosopher. You know,
oh, Van Helsing, you must stop Dracula.
I never saw it. It looked like such garbage.
Dude, it's AIDS. It is.
Yeah, it looked like film AIDS. It's celluloid AIDS.
And it's funny when they released one of the special edition DVD sets, it came with it came with Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Wolfman with it. And I was like, yeah, they have to package better movies with this shitty fucking movie to make you buy it. You know?
Yeah, it's
like watch these great movies that inspired this movie that's nothing like the movie you're about to watch.
They don't get it, and I know that Universal's doing a new Mummy, and supposedly they're aiming more for suspense and not doing it as like a big CGI action.
I'll believe it when I see it.
I don't know, but it's, since Tom Cruise is in it, who knows?
Nope.
You know, but it amazes me that they're so inept at rebooting these things. They could be doing Dracula films today, and they don't.
They did Dracula Untold, John.
they claimed he was the Muslim killer. Vlad.
Cool. Well, and even Coppola did that in his Dracula.
Yeah, movie. He wrote that in, and that all came from the Dan Curtis Jack Palance TV version. Like, and I've argued with people over that endlessly, and I said Bram Stoker did not base Dracula on Vlad Tepes. He may not have even known who Vlad Tepes was.
He didn't. It's goofy.
And Dracula's not supposed to be a romantic hero. He's a monster. You watch the Christopher
Lee movies. You know what he is? He's a goddamn plague rat. That's what he is.
He's the only vampire that isn't some fey homosexual character who doesn't look threatening at all. You know, like that's all vampires in most movies. He's like, it's Christopher Lee portrays him as alpha male monster. You know?
Yeah, he's alpha male monster. He's also a disease. Like
exactly.
When he's in an area, he poisons everything around him. And I think that's one thing like the Japanese people who made the Castlevania games really got, because that's what they portray him as in those games.
Christopher Lee was at one time the highest paid actor in the world. So it's because of those Dracula films.
Yeah, that's right. Although the Magic Christian didn't help him much.
He probably got a fat paycheck.
He would have done, without a doubt. And plus, you know, being a film with Ringo Starr and Peter Sellers.
Yeah. You
know, hanging out with some mates. But I'm going to say this, and it's going to sound really odd. I was talking to a couple of friends, went out to dinner with a week or two back. And we were talking about Dracula films and the whole glut of Dracula films that came out in the 70s. You know, the Frank Langella one, and there was the Jack Palance one. Was that the 70s as well sometime?
Yeah, it was a TV movie in the 70s.
Yeah. The best one was actually Dracula Sucks, the adult one. No, honestly, like production-wise, production values, it was brilliant. It was shot in the castle, and I also said to him at the time was, yeah, it's got sex in it, obviously being an adult film, but it's not wall-to-wall gonzo shit like you see these days. But the thing is, you can cut that out and make it a proper, because it's got a proper story.
That was probably the intention, like for different markets, like Taiwan, where they can't accept nudity.
They do. Yeah, there's two cuts of it. There's one that's strictly all the adult stuff cut out, and it's just a horror movie, which runs about 75 minutes, and then there's the longer version, which runs about, I think, 93, 94 minutes with the adult action intact. And if you were to cut out the adult stuff, it's a damn good movie, and it's well acted as well. So,
Well, you know, brother, the porn back then had real production values.
Well, yeah, this is, what, 78 when it came out. So, yeah, it was a...
acting.
They actually gave a fuck about their films back then. Not now, you know. They actually cared about them then.
It's a home video voyeur market, so...
Well, now it's a damn internet voyeur market. It's all shot.
Yeah, it's not even shot on tapes
enough anymore. You know, it's all just like
let me upload.
Yeah, exactly. Shoot it today and upload it tomorrow. Yeah, that's all it is. Shit.
But yeah, the thing is, I realize there is no new Bela Lugosi. There is no new Karloff. No new Vincent Price. There's no Basil Rathbones.
They won't be. They're gone. They're a bygone era.
Yeah, it's like this idea of good acting in a monster film, and
they don't have performers like that anymore because they don't go through the same training, you know.
And if they do, they're simply mimicking them. That's all they're doing. They're not being natural. Yeah.
And also, studios used to really curate their stars.
Yes,
right?
They did.
They used to really have a lot of control over them, and that doesn't happen anymore either. They used to be like, okay, you'll be seen in public like this, you know. They really made sure to cultivate an image.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm sure they told Bogey back then, none of your left wing shit. Don't mention that to the press.
None of your left wing shit.
None of your shit lib stuff, Bogey.
But how many actors these days are contracted to studios? It doesn't happen anymore.
They sign deals now.
Yeah,
it's like, and the deals give the actor all the control, which is ridiculous.
I think the other one might have been Tom Cruise to Paramount. It might be the last of them.
Well, yeah, that was
a development deal. He got to approve everything. Paramount couldn't tell him what to make.
Yeah, it was like a funny thing. It wasn't like a contract where they have any control over him.
Yeah, and he gets producer credit on everything, and it's his production company. And yeah, Eddie Murphy signed a similar deal.
Wasn't that back when he was working with Paula Wagner?
Yes, and the brilliant God Emperor Mel Gibson made a similar deal with. I think with his production company, Icon Productions. It's like
I listened to that Apocalypto episode I couldn't make at the last minute last week, and Icon I think went back as far as Hamlet in 1990.
Yeah,
I think
Franco Zeffirelli.
Yeah,
film.
Yeah.
Lethal Weapon 2 made him probably the biggest star in Hollywood at that time.
It wasn't Bird on a Wire. That's for sure. No, it was a terrible.
That was unfortunately a side result of the success of Lethal Weapon 2.
But I'll give you a fun fact about Mel Gibson's father. You were talking about Hutton Gibson. Hutton. Yeah, he was a quiz show champion in Australia.
Oh, I'm sure he was a smart guy.
Yeah, but he was on a quiz show. Actually, he was like a carryover champion for like days or maybe weeks. I didn't even want a stack of money on it.
Well, here's the thing: it's not stupid people that fall for the Holocaust revisionism stuff. It's really smart guys like Bobby Fischer, who's tend to something goes wrong in the wiring and they get real obsessed on certain things.
It's people in Le Chateau Autiste.
Yeah, it's like it's not like dummies. It's not like some hick in a trailer park. It's usually really smart people that kind of go for these kooky things.
Sometimes really smart people of the Hebrew faith like David Cole.
Yeah.
anybody who wants to look up one of the stranger Hollywood sagas of recent, look up David Cole.
A person
John and I are a little in arm's distance too.
I once discussed Lucio Fulci with him on my Facebook page and didn't know who he really was. But,
he invited me to his Facebook groups and his online.
Yeah,
groups.
Yeah.
No, thanks, Oven Dodger.
No. Thank you, Mel.
but I mean, the funny thing is, if you read interviews with like Mel Gibson, he's a smart guy. He reads stuff, and he's not some dumb actor that is basically read scripts by his agent.
That's his Australian education there. Thank you very much.
Probably.
We would be. Yeah.
Yeah.
I read a book at on Mel Gibson, and I may have brought it back before in the past, but the actor, they said that Mel Gibson can be wild and get out of control and tend to say things at times, and they said when he's in Australia, there's only one person who couldn't really control him, and that's the goose from Mad Max, Steve Hussle.
Really?
Exactly. Yeah, he goes, Mel, settle it down a bit, and he goes, he can bring him down to earth a bit. So I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah,
I have to find this book. You have to send me a link to it or something.
Yeah, I've still got it on the shelf. I'll look up the author and send you a link.
Yeah, I'll try to find that because here we just got the gossipy.
And how Mel Gibson hit some guy's car and back in the mid 70s, just after he made Tim or whatever it was, and he promised to pay the guy back $2 a week. He never ended up paying it back. It was like a $600 bill or something.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, he goes, I promise I'll pay it back. And he never did. He's like, $2 a week.
Well, I think I heard he was bipolar, so he probably forgot about it 90 days later.
It would make sense with his mood swings.
Oh, yeah, I think he's definitely bipolar.
Yeah, but they are promoting the shit out of Hacksaw Ridge over here. It's
billboards, dude, they're promoting TV, it here too. Yeah. They're pushing for Oscars and all that. I'm totally
gonna go see that.
Hollywood. This is the first movie I'm excited for in a long time. Hollywood is really they're basically poised to welcome Mel back into the fold.
I wonder if he gets nominated. How many people are going to turn their back if he wins at the Academy Awards?
Yeah, I
hope Mel says, "Turn around, you ungrateful pricks."
I hope he does say
I
that.
I hope he goes on a rant. He won.
It's the greatest Oscar moment ever.
I would actually watch it if I knew that was going to happen. I never watch the Oscars.
Who are they to judge him? Half of them are probably casting couch rapists and child molesters.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, half of them probably passed Corey Feldman and Corey Haim around, you know.
Oh, exactly.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And all the others. But that was like when Ilya Kazan won that Lifetime Achievement Award back
And
De Niro and Scorsese turned their back. I thought,
Scorsese didn't. He's been a he presented.
No, he walked out with him. Scorsese walked out with him.
Okay, so who Scorsese? Turned? Okay, sorry. There was Nick.
No, it
was Nick
Ed.
Nolte.
It was Ed Harris. And
Ed Harris.
Wife.
Nick Nolte.
Warren Beatty, it should be noted, was standing up and clapping, and he was telling other people to.
It was brilliant. It's like Kazan was a great director. He was. Yes. He was legit.
That's right. De Niro and Scorsese handed it to him, but boy, you could see they were uncomfortable about it.
Well, even Scorsese has, you know, watch any of his documentaries about film and he just worships Kazan, like worships him.
Yeah. Well, they made that film, what was it, Guilty by Suspicion together. I think they're both in it, Scorsese and De Niro, as actors, not as a director.
I've never seen it because nothing bores me more as a topic than The Blacklist.
I'm sorry, but McCarthy was right.
Yeah.
Well, there was one good film I saw about that, that whole thing was The Front with Woody Allen as an actor, not as a director.
Yeah, that's probably a decent film.
It is actually a very good film.
And it was directed by Martin Ritt, who was Blacklist because he was a
painter. And that was also one of the first. I think that may have been the first film to really discuss it.
It was,
really.
There's something about being the first one on the topic. It's another thing to be the 10th film to beat that horse into the ground
Hey man, the first movie to discuss it was Spartacus.
Yeah, please. Most people, I guarantee 99% of the people who sat through Spartacus never even thought of communism.
No, they didn't. It was.
This is boring as shit. I can't stand it.
I think Spartacus is pretty good until after Woody Strode dies, then the movie becomes boring. And it's a lot
of
like.
I don't remember
weird
much of it. I've got a Blu-ray I've never opened that I bought for like $2 somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, it has these weird sexual innuendos. Do you prefer snails or oysters?
Yeah, well, that was restored. Most people didn't see that clip for
decades. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was restored in, like, 1990 or 91.
So the Criterion Collection presents.
Yeah, the Criterion Collection restored footage, and it was put on the home video version or VHS. And that's how I saw it, and I haven't watched the Blu-ray. But the truth is, I'd rather watch a Steve Reeves peplum than watch Spartacus, because at least it's over in 90 minutes, and I know it's going to be entertaining, and it's got Mario Bava set design, so there you go.
Oh, yeah.
Or, to swing it back, we could watch a Universal film in 65 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the classics like Frankenstein is super short, and it's like, why don't they think about that today?
Oh, my God. When I watched Bride of Frankenstein, it runs 75 minutes. It felt like 25.
And it's perfect. It's perfect. It's tight.
It is.
It's tight as a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader's belly.
And
it's great.
And it's they're directed perfectly, they're edited perfectly, there's no fat on them, and they're I think higher art than a lot of what is considered critic praised by the critics Oscar worthy material these days.
And I think Spike Lee took inspiration from it when he made the movie She Hate Me. When I read that title, I read it in Karloff going, "She Hate Me."
Yeah.
That should be retitled, "The Whole Fucking World Hates Me."
It should be retitled, "He Looks Like a Cricket." By Eddie Murphy.
Shelton the Cricket. There you go.
She hates me.
There you go. The left are going to have Shelton the Cricket, and we'll have Pepe the Frog.
the left has kind of gotten their ass burned by the whole Pepe thing. They can't match the wit of it, and they can't understand it, so...
Yeah.
They don't have the meme magic, fam.
They really don't.
It is really funny to see how behind they all are, because they all thought they were so brilliant. They all thought they created the internet, and then they're
and that they own culture, and that they and that they own culture, and that
I have to give these young kids credit. They are not falling for the same shit that my generation.
I mean, like, you know, people give millennials a lot of shit, but I think this election has shown that there is hope.
Nah, it's like I tell you, these 4chan guys, these Encyclopedia Dramatica guys are not falling for this shit. I love it. I think it's great. It's inspiring, you know.
Yeah, like the ghoul, the counter signal memes for Fasci Goys guy.
Yeah.
Like that guy is a meme master. You know? Like, that page is one of the funniest fucking things.
But every time I see those drawings, and it's like, oh my god, there's an argument I've had with somebody. It just nailed it.
Just remember America as well. If Trump wins, you can thank the Australian hero Julian Assange for it all.
Yeah. And I love one of my favorites is this close up of a mouth like cackling. It says, "You think I'm a typical leftist? I read Stirner."
All right, boys. I think we better rate this thing.
I think we're done. Stuart, what do you give it?
I'm giving it a 7.5.
Okay, John.
I will give it a an 8.
I'll give it an 8 as well.
And keep in mind, I would give Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein a 10.
Yeah, those both are 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Essential viewing. This one, I think, is a solid 8. It gets dismissed a lot because it's not directed by James Whale. You know, like movies like Gods and Monsters dismiss it. Like, oh, they're directed by Hacks. But
Gods and Monsters just has naked men coming out of the pool and Ian McKellen drawing over. It's like, what's the point of this?
It's Clive Barker's James Whale's misunderstood gay filmmaker like me.
Oh no, it's Bill Condon's.
Well, I know, but Clive Barker produced it. That's I don't know why I just associate it with him. But
Bill Condon is a
cock.
It's funny because I think Bill Condon directed Mr. Holmes, which I actually liked a lot.
He also directed Candyman 2, Farewell to the Flesh.
And I think he directed one of the Twilight films, didn't he?
He did the last two installments.
Yeah, whatever it was.
And I think he directed Dreamgirls.
He did.
Which I also just endured.
We're just killing Bill Condon's career by talking about it.
and another sex movie, Kinsey, with Liam Neeson.
Oh, yeah, because they all worship Jesus pervs. Christ.
Degenerates, dildos.
Is that about the Kinsey Report?
No. I don't trust it. I don't trust it.
It's one of those things where I'm like, what is this going to add to my life? Nothing.
Yeah. It's like reading Freud. Nobody uses Freud as a reference point anymore. It's like, what's the point?
Yeah, it's like a really early foray into this stuff that's, you know, much more complicated than he thought. Or maybe more simple. I don't know. I never.
So, did you boys get your screener for Dangerous People yet?
I did.
Yes, I haven't opened it to see what fake title he put on mine.
Oh, you haven't?
Mine just says Dangerous People. Mine doesn't say Rob Zombie's 31.
He'd say Devil's Rejects or something.
Yeah, probably something you dislike.
Yeah.
Because I opened up and go, I said, oh, Garrow's being a smart ass goobon.
He should have wrote Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, really. There's a missed opportunity there.
I will have to go invest in a proper mic, so that's probably that task.
Well, he and I sort of hashed out the best way to do it for us to record that commentary, because we're going to get onto that soon, and should be good fun to do.
We should prepare really intellectual, faux intellectual sexual questions for Garrow. Like, so what are you trying to say about the female?
I actually said him. I have got some questions I need to ask. He goes, ask away. I don't care.
we should pretend to be really intellectual and like be like, so what are you trying to say about
Tata in the flesh?
Are you trying to subvert the male gaze with this shot?
Does the showing of the woman's labia represent female empowerment by any chance?
Yeah. Is this nudity, while it is titillating, is it also meant to be empowering?
He'll just come back and say, no, I'm just trying to show you all some pussy for a long time.
I actually am curious if that nudity is a hindrance for any sales and foreign sales, because we have all this hysterical bullshit going on about rape culture and how movies shouldn't have female nudity. And when's the last time you...
That,
When is the last time you saw a good topless scene in an R-rated film?
Garrow, are you encouraging rape culture?
Yeah, what's the last memorable nude scene you remember in a mainstream
movie? He would love it if people were fucking trying to get this film banned or, you know, off the shelves or... Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah, he would revel in it.
No, but yeah, memorable nude scene. They don't exist anymore because porn's everywhere, you know?
Yeah, I remember they made a big deal about Halle Berry getting like $1 million to do topless for that Swordfish movie, but it wasn't like a great scene or anything. It was boring. There's no sexual context to it. Monsters Ball, I guess, was a big deal, but, you know.
Monsters Ball kind of was, like Scarlett Johansson bared all in, like, what was that, the Jonathan Glazer movie she was in.
Where she was an alien?
Yes. Yeah, but it's not sexual at all. It's just like predatory.
Yeah, nobody mentioned it. No, nobody cares.
Nobody cares, you know.
And that used to be a selling point.
I need to leave that shit to the professionals. Yeah.
Well, anyway, guys.
Before we go, I want to give a shout out to Eddie and Colleen Medina at their podcast Figments over on the Jedi Cole Universe, JediCole.com. Great show. I listen every week when it's out, and they were kind enough to give us a shout out. And they just encountered a whole bunch of trouble after the Amityville Horror episode dropped. Did you hear about that?
No. What happened?
They got a death threat from one of the actual Lutz kids.
Oh, of course, because the Lutz kids want to claim it's all real.
No, he had a problem with Eddie putting the artwork up of a collage of pictures, but one of the pictures on there was of this guy's mother and sister. And he just went off threatening to come down to Dallas and kill him in front of his wife. I was like, this is just ridiculous. What the fuck, man? So...
Well, that is a family of insane idiots.
I'll have to listen to it and also to hear our plug if they call us intelligent, because that always baffles
me. Oh, no, Eddie was very kind of the plug. He did it at the start of the show, so I'm like, I've got my note here. I've got to give Eddie and Colin a plug for their show, for Figments. So get over there. They just released number 13. By the time you get this, I dare say 14 would be out. And, JediCole.com, JediCole.com. Hunter knows who I'm talking about there, obviously.
Yep, and also, don't be confused. That's not Paul Stanley hosting the show.
It's not Paul Stanley.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. It's good. I think you'll dig it, John. It's they talk about Amityville Horror. They talked about the Urban Legends as well before that. And they did like Haunted Places in Texas was another one, because they're both Texans, obviously.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's really good podcast. It's a lot of fun, and it's family friendly. You know, it's clean. There's no swearing. It's a complete contrast to this show.
You know? we're not even suitable for most adults.
No, we're family entertainment.
We'll trigger your ass.
Manson family, maybe.
You're still blue-pilled. You're going to get triggered listening to us.
Oh, if they haven't switched off already and run off screen.
Rustled. Jimmy's rustled.
Yeah. I'm sure plenty of people have tuned in and said, fuck these guys.
Oh, without a doubt.
And good. Bye.
Yeah. I'd rather have the ones who get it. You know what? I'd rather have a smaller audience, I've always said, of people who get what we're doing, compared to a larger audience of people going to get, you know, triggered and, you know.
I agree, because I don't want complaints. I've had, like, some complaints, but they're smart questions and...
Yeah, constructive criticism.
I get it. It's constructive, and I get it, you know.
Yeah. Like, if people say, look, you guys talking about a bunch of politics, it's like, okay, we get it. We probably do.
But most movie shows do. It's just on the other side of the aisle. So
yeah, you know, it's like if really you're offended by what we say politically, you're too bubbled by hearing all these other podcasts talk about what wonderful liberals they are. It's like
reading every movie through the leftist lens, like the Roger Ebert lens. You know,
yeah, being pedestered.
Exactly, and it's like, and we most of our guests have been liberal. That's a total fact. And some are extreme leftist and radicals.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's
some of them we're not friends with anymore.
it's just, but that's the truth. It's like, we'll have anybody on the show. We're not.
We don't say, oh, hi, what's your name? What's your political view? We don't do that. I mean, you know, if you're a liberal and whatever, you know, it's not, yeah.
We want diversity of thought. Yes. Yeah. We don't discourage it.
No, we're not a bunch of SJWs who are. I mean, I would even have AIDS Skrillex on the show.
I would. It'd be hilarious.
Yeah, and Carl the Cuck, and I think it'd be fantastic, but it will never happen.
No.
I wish someone would do an animated series of those guys, like Beavis and Butthead. It would just be extraordinary.
Carl the Cuck and AIDS Skrillex.
I think some are trying, but a lot of these guys don't. There aren't as teched up.
Look up, if you want some comedy, John, you might be aware of this, but look up AIDS Skrillex's hardcore band, the little documentary that was done on them. Did you see that?
I'm totally going to find it. All right.
No, Gavin covered it on his show. It is fucking... It's like... It's not kidding. AIDS Skrillex's mother paid for a documentary about his hardcore band. It's like this documentary that was bought and paid for by his mom. But you know, his thing was, you're a fucking white male. You know, that's what he was screaming.
Yeah.
And, like, the video on YouTube, most of the comments were saying, your mom's a fucking white whale. I think we got better stick a fork in it, guys.
Yeah, we're starting to social justice warriors. It's time to, yeah. Turn the timer off on this one. It's done.
Turn the timer off.
Yeah.
It's been cooked.
Cooked and ready to pull apart.
Extra crispy.
Is that the name of Mel Gibson's next movie?
Well, I was doing the
effort to reply on a certain thread. So
the extra crispy kernel from the new KFC commercials. Well, let's wrap it up. Visit us on iTunes and please rate and review and give us a rating, because that helps the show immensely. So that's a good way to go and support us. And visit us at midnightmoviecowboys.com, midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Join our Facebook group. It's growing. Getting lots of love over there. Go give love or hate and then get kicked out. Whatever.
No, we don't kick people out. We don't do that sort of shit. We're not. KISS podcast out there with a very idiot out there who, as soon as you say one word against them, just boots you and blocks you. It's like, we're not that crappy, you know.
No. Look,
state your point. You know what? State your point. If you've got a good point, we'll listen to it. If you're just being abusive, well, then expect to get back what you give. Yeah, expect to get back what you give.
But you know, listen, Stuart. Don't give Gene Simmons too much crap.
No, it's not Gene Simmons I'm talking about.
I know.
The Golem. No, he's...
Well, as I said, we're the show for people who've been red-pilled. We're the movie podcast for the red pill.
Yes.
That's a good thing. Actually, good point. Go spread the word about us, not just on Facebook and stuff like that. Yeah, it's good you're doing that, but do it in forums and anywhere. Just...
Well, if you have like-minded friends, please tell them. Tell them to go listen. Like-minded friends who are movie fans, you know.
I should say we got praise on the... the original Night Stalker crime boards for actually doing a good show on the Aaron's case.
Yeah, it was like a redemption for the first one we did. We were, and I just treated it as a big, That's still actually getting comments, that is. And then one guy came in defense of us on YouTube, on our YouTube, YouTube video Cameron put up with that episode.
Right.
So it's starting to get more traction in comments. Some guys starting to shit on us, and then another guy said, no. I defend these guys and was just blasting all the other ones. So that was pretty cool.
Look at that.
Yeah. All right, fellas. All right. I think we're done.
Yep. And with that, I'm going to say adios.
And I'll say Magadog.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.
Thank you.